Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 17th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, not-so-scientific ways to select scientific software, how we taste what we taste, and the latest on fracking.
Based on the data, there is really no scientifically proven evidence that hydraulic fracturing has contaminated the drinking water.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Hydraulic fracturing of rock, or fracking, has been around since the 1940s, but until recently, it was too expensive to bring into widespread use. For the last 20 years, as fuel prices have gone up and technology has improved, fracking has been surging, particularly for unconventional, difficult-to-extract fossil fuels like shale gas. Almost as quickly as fracking has spread, so have questions about its environmental impact, particularly whether chemicals can escape the drilling wells and contaminate drinking water. Radoslav Vidic, author of a review this week, spoke with me about fracking and water quality, focusing on a rock formation in Pennsylvania called the Marcellus Shale.
Fracking is a technology that allows us to access vast quantities of natural gas that are locked in the glassy rock that's called shale. And this rock sits about a mile deep, and it's glassy, meaning that it doesn't have much permeability, but it contains a lot of gas. So in order to release the gas, we have to shatter the glass. We have to break that glass apart and create a lot of little fractures and fissures so that would allow the gas to be released and flow into the well. So you basically drill a hole through the shale, and then you pump water under very high pressure to open up existing hairline fractures and create new fractures. And then you also pump some sand in there, so when you take the water out, the sand will keep the fractures open and allow the gas to flow freely into the well.
Let's talk about hydraulic fracturing fluids. So the fluids that are used to lubricate the drill bit, to fracture the rock, to prop it open, it's not just water. So what else is contained in these fracking fluids, and is any of it toxic or hazardous?
The hydraulic fracturing fluid has to have three components in it. Well, actually five. It has water, it has sand that's carried as a propant, and then the three main components is basically friction reducer to lubricate the pipe so it reduces the friction so the water will flow in. Anti-scalants to prevent any scale formation downhole. And then the third one is antimicrobial agent or disinfectant to prevent the biological growth in the hydraulically fractured well so that it would prevent the reduction in permeability. Some of these chemicals are toxic, obviously, if you are ingesting them, if you're drinking them. Anything in large quantities is probably toxic for humans.
So as you say in your paper, every horizontal well in the Marcellus Shale, for example, that requires hydraulic fracturing uses up about 2 to 7 million gallons of water. It's estimated that only about 9 to 53% of that water is recovered. So what happens to the rest? Where does it go?
Well, the rest stays in the subsurface and comes out throughout the life of the well. Take an example of Marcellus Shale. That's a very, very dry rock. Doesn't have any water in it. So when you inject the water in there, a lot of the water is going to be held in the shale where the capillary forces, it imbibes or it absorbs into the shale. So some of that water will never come out.
And perhaps it's also important to note that the horizontal wells that are being hydraulically fractured are really quite deep. Can you just describe where all of this is happening in relation to the aquifers where people are getting their drinking water?
So the gas wells that are being put right now into the Marcellus, they go about a mile deep. The groundwater aquifers where we draw most of the groundwater for drinking water supply are maybe on the order of 800 feet, 1,000 feet at the most. Modern designs, you know, have at least three steel pipes with three layers of cement in between, with the whole purpose being to protect the aquifer against any potential leaks out of the well and so forth.
Okay, so now for the water that is recovered, that 9 to 53% that comes back out of the well. What do we then do with that?
At the moment, we have two strategies for handling wastewater that comes out of these wells. And that is the most important environmental issue that we have to pay attention to. One way is to take this water, inject it in a Class II disposal wells and bury it in the subsurface. And that's been practiced in the western part of the states. In Pennsylvania, we don't have this injection well, so we invented recycling and being able to reuse this water. However, the recycling strategy works only as long as you have another well to inject this water into. Once you run out of wells, we'll be generating excess water. So these gas well fields will become net water producers. And we have to think now, what are we going to do with all that water that's going to be coming out of these wells, you know, in 10, 15 years? People focus very much on what exactly are the chemicals that we're putting in the frack fluid. In my opinion, much more significant is what comes back out, because the quality of the water that comes back out is many, many times worse than the quality of water that we inject into the well.
How is this water so much worse than what goes in? What exactly is coming out?
You're coming back out with so many salts, with bromide, with barium, with strontium. You come back out with the organics, because this is an organic-rich rock.
Did I read correctly that this is also radiogenic?
Yes. There is some natural occurring radioactive material. The radium-226 is the dominant component of the natural occurring radioactive material that occurs in the subsurface. And that comes back out of the shale. It's not something that we put in there.
So there's a lot of concern about water contamination in fracking areas. The USGS, the EPA, a lot of agencies and other organizations have been out there testing water. So what's actually happening with the drinking water in Pennsylvania? What do the data show?
Based on the data, there is really no scientifically proven evidence that the hydraulic fracturing has contaminated the drinking water, meaning the groundwater. Mm-hmm. There has been some impacts on the surface water, and that's primarily from the centralized waste treatment facilities that are grandfathered in, and they have a permit to treat the water from shallow wells, not the Marcellus, but the shallow wells, and they discharge into the rivers. But that impact is sort of local, because by the time these rivers flow into Ohio River, the dilution is very significant, and so you don't see much of it.
Hmm.
Except in the case of bromide, that we're seeing some evidence that there is little higher levels of bromide in the Allegheny River watershed, and jury's still out trying to figure out exactly why is it, you know, at the higher levels from the background that used to be there.
And a number of videos have been circulating, some online, some in documentaries, of people being able to light their water on fire because of high methane concentrations. Is this correlated at all with fracking operations?
If you talk to anybody who lived in Pennsylvania all their lives, and a long time ago, the kids used to play games and light the water on fire, because there's a lot of methane in groundwater in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, because all of these regions sit on top of the coal, and the coal by itself contains gas. And so a lot of the background levels have been elevated for a very, very long time. And if you take an example of that Gasland movie, you know, that guy in Colorado who lights his tap on fire, that particular person has received notices from Colorado Department of Environmental Protection that his water contains high levels of methane, because his wells are going through two layers of coal down deep. And so he knows that this has been there long before any hydraulic fracturing came into town.
So you mentioned bromide levels earlier. You also talk in your paper about areas where saline concentrations might be higher than in others. Mm. Why is it so hard to suss out the background concentrations of these chemicals versus how they might have been changing more recently?
The biggest problem that we have in Pennsylvania is that Pennsylvania is one of two states in the U.S. that doesn't require monitoring of private wells, you know, groundwater wells that people use for drinking. So there is really no background information in Pennsylvania on what the groundwater quality was 30, 40 years or 20 years ago before the hydraulic fracturing started. And so you don't have a baseline to compare with. The other problem is that the surface water quality monitoring network that exists in Pennsylvania and other states is not very dense. So it's going to require a lot more effort in terms of tracking and monitoring background levels to be able to detect any changes in the groundwater or in the surface water, for that matter. Mm-hmm. The other issue is that there is a lot of data that different companies and different entities have that have been collected since the hydraulic fracturing started, but these data are proprietary because of the privacy issues and so forth. And so I think I really would implore everybody involved to share the data so we can actually get a true picture of what's going on before we make any decisions or any conclusions.
As you said, the jury is really still out scientifically on whether or not fracking is in any way affecting groundwater in places like Pennsylvania. So what needs to happen for the scientific community to reach a consensus on this?
Well, I think the most important thing is to share the data, to put the data out in the public domain so that people can look for themselves rather than anecdotal evidence or stories and so forth. The other one is we have to enhance our ability to track the water quality in Pennsylvania and other states where the hydraulic fracturing is going on. So we have to improve the network of surface water quality monitoring stations. We have to improve the requirements to monitor the groundwater for drinking water purposes. So it's a matter of a measuring and tracking and sharing the information that will be really critical to assess any potential impact. And then there's a lot of things that can be done in scientific domain to better understand the flow pathways and fate and transport of contaminants and so forth, you know, but that would be secondary. I think the first thing to do is to have the foolproof effort, you know, going on to track the water quality and put the data out there for people to see.
Radoslav Vidic, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie.
Radoslav Vidic and colleagues write about fracking and water quality in a review this week.
Hey everyone, this week's show is sponsored by Audible, and there's a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're having difficulty choosing, I recommend A Briefer History of Time by Stephen Hawking. It's a 2005 follow-up to the original 1988 tome, and although it's more up-to-date, it's still a classic summary of how everything that we know got to be the way that it is today.
Okay, I hope you get a chance to check out that book and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. How many times have you gotten a 5-minute software tutorial? Be it a complex operation in Excel, a new stats package, or the user interface for a piece of lab equipment, and been sent on your way, destined to follow the same pattern without fail for the next 18 months? What happens if you check the wrong box? Can you troubleshoot or change the parameters without fear? These are all symptoms of a larger problem in the use of scientific software. I spoke to Lucas Joppa about the widespread and growing problem of adapting science to software instead of adapting the software to science.
So for those of us kind of paying attention to general overall trends in science, I think it's becoming extremely clear that the use of software isn't only transforming how science is done, but actually what science is done. And as a result of that, we've really been learning a lot about how scientific software is, or at least should be, built. But what's really remarkable here is just how little we actually do know about the drivers of scientific software adoption. So in other words, we don't actually know all that much about why scientists choose the software that they do. And I think the default assumption here has really been that scientists adopt software based on scientific considerations, just like they do in the rest of their scientific practice. What we found in our study is that a lot of scientists seem to adopt and use software critical for their research for non-scientific reasons, and that these reasons themselves can actually be scientifically limiting.
So what areas of research could be affected by the adoption of software for the wrong reasons?
Okay, sure. So our study targeted a very specific set of scientists, but there's really a lot of reasons to believe that our findings should have fairly widespread applicability across much of what we call the long tail of scientific computing. So we aren't particularly concerned about some of the more high-profile, high-visible scientific domains like high-energy physics, which employ massive teams of scientists and software engineers all working together.
Mm-hmm.
But what we think is often overlooked is that that kind of scientific computing is actually the exception to the rule. The vast majority of scientific computing actually takes place within small teams and by individuals working in disciplines pretty much as disparate as sociology or economics or anything you can really think of.
To get a closer look at this question, you surveyed researchers that do work using scientific software. How did you set up this survey differently from others that have come before?
So what we report on in our paper are the results from a survey where we targeted ecology as a specific scientific domain, but more particularly in ecological research track, species distribution modeling, and asked about how and why scientists in that domain use the software they do. So what people have done in the past is to do general surveys about computational methods or to target specific computational domains like high-performance computing. But doing that really risks a large self-selection bias, and that only people who already feel comfortable using computational methods will identify as someone who should answer the survey in the first place. So what we did, by choosing a set of scientists that are trying to understand a specific scientific question independent of computational methods, and then addressing computation through the lens of their scientific questions, that really allowed us to get responses from a really wide range of computational skill sets, from respondents who, quote, find it difficult to use software or can only cope with it, as they say, all the way to those who identified as very experienced and very technical in their skill sets. And for better or worse, I think that really is representative these days of the wide diversity of scientists using computational methods in their work.
Right. Well, what are some of the reasons that you heard for the software choices that these scientists were making?
The results of our survey were actually, from our perspective at least, a bit concerning. So many respondents reported that they relied on some form of peer review as the reason for using particular software. But what we're arguing in our paper is that this rationale is actually scientifically misplaced, because the software code used to conduct the science that they're talking about is hardly ever actually peer-reviewed. It's really just the findings reported from using that software that are. So the percent of respondents who relied on peer review was, fairly interestingly, a lot higher when we considered only those respondents who primarily use software with what we call click-and-run user interfaces, compared with respondents who primarily use software requiring them to write their own scripts or programs. And so a bit surprisingly as well, about 80% of our respondents expressed the desire to learn more software and programming skills. And so what we think this might point to is a potentially widespread worry among scientists about whether or not the software that they're using is doing what they expect it to.
Right. In your paper, you talk about end user developers. These are people in the lab who create software to undertake their scientific work. But you point out that just because an author is excellent at their research doesn't mean they're necessarily the best person to be writing the code behind a computer program. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So end-user developers are actually extremely common in the long tail of scientific computing that I've spoken about. So these are people that are both developers and users of the scientific code that they themselves create. And they often become developers by default, and that they need to build the software in the first place to do their own research. And then based on the results from using that software, the scientific community starts to want to use the software, and the scientist then becomes a bit more than a scientist, and that they're trying to push on with their own research while maintaining and disseminating software that they built themselves. So, of course, most often, these scientists' formal training was not in software development, but in a scientific field separate from that computation. And so now you have this system where research-critical software is being built by people without any formal training in software development, and then being relied upon by a broader scientific community to support their own research. And so as the importance of computational science rises, that foundation is becoming much more shaky.
So another thing that you point out in your paper is this mismatch between a published equation from scientific research and an algorithm that's inside of the program. Can you talk about the gap that can exist there?
Sure. So the potential for mismatch between the equations published in a scientific paper and the way those are instantiated in computer code gets really to the heart of one of the problems here. So if the source code for a scientific software is not open or peer-reviewed, how's anyone actually supposed to know whether or not the software they're using does what it says on the tin, you know, as they say? So this becomes especially problematic when you're thinking about dynamic, stochastic modeling problems, where there really is no data oracle to benchmark your software against. So in other words, these are problems where you can't actually know that the software is doing something correctly without running the software, which in of itself becomes a bit of a computational catch-22. And to be honest, these are fundamental issues, really, that software engineering as a field is still grappling with and trying to come to grips with.
Right. So what are some of the steps that you recommend be taken in order to address some of these issues?
Sure. Okay. So the first most obvious thing to be done is just to make the source code to scientific software inspectable by those who are using it. So this isn't the current status quo in scientific publishing. You don't often have to publish the software code that goes with scientific analyses. And so this has been called for several times over the past few years, including in high-profile papers in Science itself. But what my co-authors and I argue here in our paper is that simply making source code open is a necessary but insufficient criterion for solving the problem. And that's because most individuals operating out in this long tail of scientific computing really aren't trained in the areas that they would need to be trained in to even read, much less comprehend, the source code to software. So dealing with all this is a pretty big challenge, and one that we think needs to be addressed in several ways. So the first and immediate thing that we think could be done here would be to require not only that source code be made open for inspection after the publication of the software, but also that the source code itself be peer-reviewed. So this could be done, of course, as part of the standard journal reviewing process, but that again would require the pool of peer reviewers to be expert enough to review the source code. And we know that's already a problem. So instead, we're really seeing kind of short-term promise in journals or services that exist explicitly to review computer code, perhaps in the same way that many journals, such as Science, require papers to be written to a certain standard of English. And journals can educate, too, by publishing short tutorials within their domain on computational standards and methods within the field. And then long-term, really, this is a major issue for scientific education curriculum to address. So making sure that graduates are fundamentally capable of conversing in their disciplines and with their colleagues is, of course, incumbent on training institutions. So these conversations used to include the old standbys, right, of mathematics and statistics and so on. But now they must also include computational methods and engineering. At the same time, of course, when you're talking about even longer term, the basics of computer science and user interaction design really are going to have to start considering how to overcome or mitigate some of these issues as well. So all in all, I think you'd probably agree, it's a pretty big ask, but that's a big ask to a pretty big problem. And so we really do feel this is at least worth tackling, given the disproportionate impact that computational science is having and will continue to have on scientific issues of societal importance.
Okay. Well, Lucas Joppa, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Lucas Joppa and colleagues write about scientific software standards in a policy forum this week.
When you bite into an apple, the flavor that your brain registers is a result of much more than just the chemical components of the fruit interacting with your taste buds. To gain a better understanding of all the factors involved in taste and flavor, food science is going interdisciplinary. I spoke with Kai Kupferschmidt, who visited food labs around Europe and caught up on the latest in the science of flavor.
There's two different concepts in food science. There's taste and there's flavor. And taste is really what we perceive by the taste buds on our tongues. And then there's flavor, which is so much more. It's the experience you have when you eat something. It's, say, the crunchiness of the food as well. It's how it smells, the texture, all of these things together. And I guess scientists are making progress, particularly in understanding what contributes to flavor. So, for example, there is the taste factor. So people have found genetic differences in people who perceive certain foods differently. But they're also starting to understand how, for example, volatiles or the expectations we have of certain foods contribute to the overall flavor. So, for example, there's a study that showed that certain tomatoes seem sweeter to us when we taste them, even though they actually have less sugar in them. And that's because certain volatiles that we perceive in the nose make the flavor sweeter than the actual taste would be. I think the really big question is, how do all of these different things, the genetics, the physiology, the psychology, come together to create this flavor experience? Why do we like certain foods and dislike others? Why do we learn to like some foods? And also, you know, will we be able to use this knowledge to create foods that taste even better, to have something like the Newtonian mechanics of cooking?
Now that we're talking about the science of taste, let me ask you a few burning questions that I've been having. So why do some flavors go really well together and some of them don't? For instance, peanut butter and jelly, to me, just feel like they're made to go together.
not sure I'd agree with that. But there are a few different theories on why some foodstuffs go together. So, for example, say wine and olives, you know, some people say these go very well together because they both have a certain sour taste. So if you drink the wine, the sour taste gets activated, and then when you eat the olives, the sour doesn't register as much. So basically, you know, one food kind of primes us for the other one. Hmm. That might be a reason why, if they share a certain flavor component, some foods go well together. But we really don't know that well. I mean, steak and sauce béarnaise to me is a perfect combination, but really nobody's been able to explain why that is.
And as you said, you actually don't like peanut butter and jelly. There are other foods like that too, particularly cilantro. Some people really like. To others, it really tastes quite nasty. What are the reasons for those personal differences in taste?
Scientists have actually found genetic variants that seem to affect how people perceive cilantro. Some people describe the taste as very soapy. These are usually the people who don't like cilantro, and they seem to have a different variant of one certain taste receptor. But the effect of these genetic differences isn't quite clear. So the genetic variant that they found recently, for example, even the authors say that it only accounts for about 0.5% of the variants in how people perceive cilantro.
And I can imagine that for certain flavors that we tend to prefer or not, there might even be an evolutionary purpose for that.
Certainly evolution forms the basis for our taste preferences. So it's been known for a while that human beings, pretty much from the moment they're born, they tend to like sweetness, they tend to not like bitterness or sourness. And that's a very basic way in which these tastes make us choose food. So sweetness means there's calories in the food, so that's important, especially for newborn babies. So these basics are really hardwired into us. I think what scientists are really interested in now is what goes on top of that. So why do we start to learn to like some bitter food, some sour food? There's some indication that learning these things goes on all our lives, and that this is really important for why we have these acquired tastes. Just like people learn sometimes to like cigarettes, even though most people, when they try their first cigarette, really can't stand the taste.
And then earlier you mentioned the expectation of food can even change our perception of it. Tell me a little bit about the psychology of taste.
Yeah, there was a fascinating experiment done by a scientist in Potsdam in Germany who looked at how viewing certain pictures before you taste something changes how you perceive the taste. So they showed photos of high-calorie food or low-calorie food, and then all the participants got the same basic taste sensation by actually giving them a short electric current through the tongue that creates a standardized sensation that's slightly metallic. And those people who actually saw pictures of high-calorie food afterwards described that taste as nicer than those who'd seen photos of low-calorie food. So even just seeing certain food seems to impact on how we perceive a flavor.
Now, I imagine that, especially when talking about the psychology of taste, that as much as we can design experiments to test these sorts of perceptions, that probably chefs and restaurant owners actually have a lot of experience with this as well. I mean, I imagine there could be a lot that scientists and these chefs could learn from one another.
Yes, there is. And I think it's fascinating that actually people haven't really done that in the past. So in the last few years, scientists have started collaborations with chefs and people working in gastronomy to explore some of these questions, but that's a fairly new development still. It really started with scientists being interested in how cooking changes food physically, for example, and that kind of started those collaborations going, and now both sides of this collaboration are really profiting from it. So some people in these food labs are developing new foods with scientific technologies, and then on the other hand, the scientists can sometimes use these new foods as well to test certain hypotheses about how people react to new food.
So where are a few of these partnerships happening?
There's one particularly famous one in Copenhagen. Until recently, the world's best restaurant, according to a very famous list, was Noma, a restaurant in Copenhagen. And they have their own research and development division, which is called the Nordic Food Lab. And it's right next to the restaurant on a houseboat, actually. And there, scientists and chefs are kind of working hand in hand, developing new recipes and also looking at the science of some of these things.
And you actually got to visit the Nordic Food Lab. Did you get to taste anything fun while you were there?
I did. They were just working on insects at the time. So René Redzepi, the chef of NOMA, is interested in trying to integrate insects more in his cuisine.
Oh, wow.
So they had been trying out a few new things. And I got to taste a very fascinating kind of soy sauce. So soy sauce or fish sauce, these are fermented sauces. And the chefs at the Nordic Food Lab tried to do this kind of sauce, but made with grasshoppers and mealworms that are fermented.
Oh, wow.
And it actually tasted really well. It tasted a lot like soy sauce, very kind of salty, but with a lot more oomph to it. It had more strength. Then the other thing I tasted was fresh bee larvae. They came from the freezer. So bee larvae have been eaten by people in many cultures. And when they come from the fridge in the cold, they taste almost like a little ice snack, like these really small pieces of ice. But they have a very creamy taste to them. I was told that they taste best when they come straight from the comb. So when they're taken out, they're still a little warm and there's, you know, honey trickling over them. That's supposed to be the best taste. But even frozen, they tasted really well.
Wow, how interesting. Okay, so we've talked a lot about the questions that scientists can't answer just yet about flavor and about taste and why we taste what we taste. What are some of the bigger questions that maybe have been answered more recently?
Well, one thing that we've learned is that food preferences already start in the womb. So if pregnant mothers are given certain foods and other pregnant mothers aren't, then you can test the babies when they're born and you can see that they actually prefer those foods that they've been exposed to, even in utero.
Hmm.
This has been done, for example, with garlic or with anise. And another thing is really that the importance of volatiles has really been recognized by scientists. So this is a fascinating process that's called retronasal olfaction. So when you eat and you swallow, a little bit of air gets pushed up at the back of your mouth, and we actually recognize the smells there. And the brain can recognize whether these smells come, you know, from retronasal olfaction, which is this process when you're eating, or whether it comes from just smelling something.
Hmm.
And these volatiles in this retronasal olfaction seems to be much more important for forming food preferences than we previously thought.
Kai Kupferschmidt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie.
Kai Kupferschmidt writes about the science of taste and flavor in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm here with David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. So, Dave, first up, we have dam deforestation.
Sarah, this story is about hydropower. This is a major source of power in the world. Turbines hooked up to dams. The water flows down, spins the turbine, and can power a lot. In fact, there's a dam that's being constructed in Brazil called the Belo Monte Dam, which is a $14 billion project. And when it's complete, it will have the third greatest capacity for generating hydropower in the world.
Okay, so what about the trees?
Well, there's a problem. To build these dams, you got to cut down a lot of trees. And that has its own ecological problems. But engineers didn't worry about the cutting down the trees themselves as a problem for the dam power. In fact, they thought that cutting down the trees would actually improve hydroelectric power. The reason being that trees suck up a lot of water from the soil. It's a process known as evapotranspiration, where the water gets sucked up into the trees. The trees transpire the water through their leaves, and that water enters the atmosphere. The idea was, because trees are sucking so much water from the ground, they're sucking the water that would otherwise be flowing into streams and rivers, and therefore the fewer trees, the more water you've got in the ground, the better it is for hydropower.
So the new finding here is that that's not really true.
That's not really true. Researchers modeled this dam being built in Brazil, and what they found was that actually trees was actually already known that trees actually play a really important role in local weather systems because of their transpiring that water up into the sky. That actually has effects on local climate, can cause added rainfall, and you can imagine the more rain you get, that's also good for hydropower. And what the researchers found is that when you clear-cut forest, you can actually reduce the amount of hydropower back to 40% from these dams because so much water is not falling anymore due to local rainfall.
What effect is this research, this finding, going to have on the building of dams in Brazil and other Amazon countries?
Well, it could change the way engineers build these dams. One thing the researchers didn't take into account is actually clear cutting has actually fallen in recent years, suggesting that it's going to be less of an issue for some of these dams. But it still indicates that trees play a very important role in hydroelectric power, a role that really wasn't very well understood before.
Mm-hmm. So next up, we have some new information about the human lineage.
That's right, Sarah. You know, something very important happened 25 to 30 million years ago. Two primate groups split off from each other. One gave rise to what are today old world monkeys, and that's animals like baboons and macaques. The other lineage gave rise to gorillas, chimpanzees, and humans. So this was a very important point in our history where we wouldn't be here if this hadn't happened. It's sort of shrouded in mystery because the genetic evidence suggests that this split happened 25 to 30 million years ago, but researchers haven't found any fossils directly related to either of these two groups dating back more than 20 million years ago. So it sort of raises this question, if we did have this split happen all this time ago, why aren't we finding fossils from early ancestors of either of these lineages around that time?
So genetic evidence is pointing to this time period.
Yeah.
And we haven't had any fossils yet, but it sounds like maybe we have found something.
Well, that's what this new study is all about. Researchers that have been digging in Tanzania, specifically a site called the Rukwa Rift Basin, found some fossils that seemed to be what they were looking for in terms of finding the ancestors of both of these lineages. The fossils were dated to about 25 million years ago, which is almost exactly the time point that you would want. And one seems to be an apparent ape ancestor. The other one seems to be an apparent old world monkey ancestor. And the way the researchers tell this is they actually look at the teeth. The fossils, actually, they don't have a whole lot to go on here. But the teeth of each fossil seems to share features that are consistent with that particular lineage.
These are ancestors, one from each lineage, but it's not the golden fossil, the one that, you know, unites these two different lines.
That's a great point. Yeah, they don't have that holy grail yet. But what's important about the find is it really starts to back up this genetic evidence. Now there's evidence of this 25 to 30 million year old split in the fossil record, which we didn't have before.
So these are pretty small pieces of the animal. It's some teeth and jaws. Is this seal the deal? Are these for sure related to the current old world monkeys and to the current great ape?
A couple excerpts that we consulted for the story think that this is very strong evidence, but one notes that there have been mistakes made in the past because, as you stated, we're dealing with very small fragments of these animals. It's possible that neither one of these is actually a primate. It could be what this one expert says is a pig-like hoofed animal. So, you know, the researchers are confident, but when you're dealing with such small fragments, you have to keep in mind that you may not always have what you think you have.
Great. Last up, we have a story about endangered species that have big populations, but not necessarily the diversity needed to maintain them.
Well, that's right, Sarah. I mean, when we think about species that are on the brink of extinction and then their numbers coming back, mm-hmm. we think that's usually a good sign. But there's a couple of new studies that have come out this week that suggested that numbers aren't everything, that there could still be problems with populations even though their numbers have recovered. Their so-called genetic diversity, which is the variety of their gene pool, may not be where it should be, and that could open up these animals to a whole host of diseases and other problems.
Well, let's start with one example that came up in the story, the tiny spotted kiwi.
This is a species known as the little spotted kiwi. It's a worm eater. It's so small it can be cradled in a child's arms. It's also very cute. There's a picture of it on the site. And this particular species was faring very poorly at the turn of the 20th century. And in 1912, officials transplanted five of these little spots, as they're known, to an island refuge where they would be safe from hunters and from predators. And lo and behold, over the decades, the species recovered, and today there are about 1,700 individuals, which from a conservation standpoint seems like good news. You've got a very large population of animals. Seems like they're in good shape.
One thing I noticed about both of the species we're going to talk about is the strange way they went about collecting their DNA for these studies.
Right. For the kiwi, what they did was they actually sent dogs after the birds that would actually locate the birds and not kill them, ideally. And then they drew blood from these birds. They compared the DNA of more than 180 of the animals. And what they found was kind of disturbing. They found that there was very little genetic variation in these birds. Genetic variation is something you really need to deal with big changes in your environment. If we're all the same and a disease hits or the weather gets suddenly warmer, we're all going to suffer the same. But if some of us are better adapted to deal with warmer weather or certain diseases or maybe even certain predators, then some of us are going to survive and go on to continue with the population and the species. But that's not what the researchers were seeing here. They were seeing very low genetic diversity, which isn't a good sign for the future of these kiwis.
And so what about the tiger?
Well, that's the other species. The other species is a Bengal tiger, a very different species, much larger. We're talking about a 220-kilogram cat that could rip you apart if he wanted to. And Bengal tigers have a similar history. You know, they were nearly hunted to extinction. Their numbers have been coming back recently. By 2011, there were an estimated 1,700 Bengal tigers in India, compared to just 1,400 in 2006. So their populations are rebounding. But again, we have this problem with genetic diversity.
And in this case, they didn't actually hunt down the tigers with dogs.
They didn't. They did two things. First of all, they wanted to compare the genetic diversity today to what it had been in the past. You can't go back in time, but you can in a way if you go to a museum. So the researchers went to museums. They looked at some Bengal tiger specimens. They were able to extract DNA from them. These are maybe about 100 years old or so. And then for the modern tigers, they actually recovered it from tiger scat, which is tiger poop. And when they compared the genetic diversity, they found that, especially in the mitochondrial DNA, this is the DNA that's passed down from mother to child, this DNA showed very little genetic diversity, which is also, again, a bad sign for the future of this population.
So what does this mean for the management of these species in the preserves or in the zoo?
Well, what it means is that the conservation of these species is going to be a lot more difficult than we thought. It's not just a question of boosting numbers. You've also got to boost this genetic diversity, which is a problem so hard that one of the experts we consulted for the article actually says that biologists can't do it alone. It's going to take a much more concerted effort, a much more dramatic effort. And again, the focus really has to be on genes in addition to numbers.
Okay. So what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about a fast and painless way to better mental arithmetic for those of us who are not great at math. Also, a story about peering inside caterpillars as they develop into butterflies, some very cool 3D images. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about corporations and the National Science Foundation teaming up to lower dropout rates of minorities and women in science and education fields. Also, a story about whether France should be using English in its universities, especially to teach science. It's a very controversial topic in France. This week's Science Live is about honeybees in trouble, why honeybees are disappearing, and what the impact of their disappearance will have on the entire world. And next week's Science Live is about the release of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, known as DSM-5. This is a manual that has all of the mental disorders, as it were. It's also very controversial in terms of what it includes, what it excludes, and what exactly it defines as a mental disorder. So we should have a really fascinating chat on that. Both of these are going to be video chats we're hosting with Google Hangouts. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site, Science Now. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the May 17th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.